Welcome back to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for software engineering leaders. I'm your host, Aaron Syme. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Sarah Milstein, an executive coach who is herself an experienced engineering leader across a variety of tech and media companies. Sarah will share with us leadership tips for high-performing teams and how to establish agreements within those high-performing teams. Now, don't forget to like and follow the Scaling Tech Podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, LinkedIn, or anywhere else you're enjoying this episode. Your support will help us to reach more engineering leaders and allow us to keep providing you with interviews just like this one. So let's get to my interview with Sarah so you can get back out there and build some high-performing engineering teams.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
Sarah Milstein has worked as a leader across tech and media companies, having previously been VP of Engineering at Daily and prior to that at ConvertKit, and in engineering leadership at MailChimp. She was also CEO and co-founder of Lean Startup Productions and holds an MBA from UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. Sarah now offers coaching for executives and emerging leaders, helping them level up in effectiveness and job satisfaction. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Sarah.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Good to speak with you again. Today, we're going to talk about high-performing teams, among other topics. So I want to start by asking, how do you define a team as high-performing? What stands out to you?
Yeah, so I kind of think about it in two ways, external and internal. By external, I mean a team that can take in requests, can properly prioritize them, can gather relevant info, and then generate an answer or a project that's appropriate for the business needs. That's the external thing. They've generated something that's appropriate for the business. But internally, a high-performing team is one that has figured out how to do those things collaboratively and by actively drawing on the relevant expertise of the team members so that everybody is participating in a respectful and satisfying way.
Really strong definition. How do you, is there something that stands out to you that lets you know that that's like collaborative within that group or from that internal perspective?
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes it's something as simple as everybody has contributed to the conversation and has had a chance to offer some particular slice of expertise. But I think that's probably the biggest thing, that they've had the chance, because not everybody's expertise is relevant to every project or question, but that the team has some way of making sure that they got all the inputs from each other, that everybody has some level of agreement on how to move forward based on the information that they have and the expertise that they have.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah, and from a external perspective, you know, you talked about coming up with the kind of the right solution for the business needs. You know, I think too of like a high performing team having a healthy and constructive is maybe the words that come to my mind, healthy and constructive, you know, discussion with the business around what those needs are, right? It's not pushing back is not necessarily the right term, right? You know, you're looking for something that is healthy and constructive. I mean, what do you see from an external perspective that, you know, say a stakeholder might say, that's the best team we have in this organization?
Well, partly, you know, when I said like they've gathered info so that the team knows to ask questions and that they can do that on a few levels. So they can ask questions when they get a request from the business. They can gather some info and then go back and clarify. It should look to stakeholders like the team is communicating with you to make sure you have the same information and that you're continuing to make decisions in an aligned way based on shared information.
So you and I first met when you were CEO at Lean Startup Productions, and then our paths have crossed again when you were VP of Engineering at Daily. So I know over the course of your career and the variety of organizations you've worked with, I'm sure you've seen a wide range of leaders. What's the most important thing that an engineering leader can do to create a culture of high-performing teams?
Yeah, so I think in general, the best leaders are able to clearly articulate company business priorities, which change over time. As you get new information as a business, you get new information about your market, about your customers, about sources of funding. There's all kinds of things that change over time. And as you do that, you can reprioritize and you're able to clearly articulate to your company what the new priorities are, why they're changing, and what you are willing to give up in order to meet new priorities. Because it's not a priority if you're just adding stuff to a list. So the big question really for leaders is, what's new and why, and what are we letting go of because we have new information now? And frankly, most leaders aren't able to do those things. More people are able to say, here's the new priority, here's new things we want to add. But it's right. not meaningful if you're not able to say, here's what we're going to deprioritize, here's what we're going to do less of or none of, we're going to do it to a different level of quality or at a different scope. Most leaders simply can't do that and or won't. And then adding things to the list is not useful.
Yeah, that's a really great insight of the importance and the power of the leader being able to proactively say, this is what we're going to deprioritize. This is what I'm willing to give up for it. Now, I think having those sorts of open and transparent discussions about trade-offs for me is definitely a really important signal of a high-performing team, right? And I think back to like in my days when I was doing agile coaching for teams and talking with them about the differences between roles and like a product owner and a scrum master and a scrum team and the engineering team, the delivery team, and who kind of owns what aspects of the process. And I often would discuss that with people and characterize in terms of what each role has to give up in the sense that, you know, say from the delivery team's perspective, they have to, not just what they give up, but what they're also gaining in return for that, right? You know, that the delivery team is the team that always owns the estimates, for example. And no one can tell them that their estimate is wrong. It's their estimate, right? They could say it doesn't fit in the schedule, but the estimate is what the team says it is, you know? But in return for that, the delivery team is essentially ceding the power to the product owner to have the final say on what priority is, right? Mm-hmm. And then kind of in reverse too, between the dynamic between like a product owner and the team too, of the product owner does have the ultimate say of kind of what we're going to work on next, the prioritization, but they also have to accept that when the team says, look, you're just asking for too much, it doesn't all fit in there. So what's most important, right? And I think that's not in high-performing teams, that I feel like that sort of thing happens pretty intuitively, though, because they've already got this culture of transparency and talking to each other in a kind of like a trade-off sort of way. But in a team that's maybe struggling to become high-performing, that can be really hard to do, to make that transition. So I like that insight from you a lot. Thank you. You know, maybe that's a good segue for us to talk a little bit about team agreements, because, you know, maybe some of those things, like I just said, are kind of an implicit or an unconscious team agreement. For a team to be high performing, what kind of team agreements are necessary? And, you know, what does that look like to you?
I think of agreements as things that, as you noted, could be explicit or could be implicit, but they are things as simple as, on what schedule do we meet? How do we decide on the agenda for the meetings? Who leads the meetings? How do we determine who speaks during them? How do we review each other's work outside of the meetings? Things like that. Those are all team agreements, how we make decisions together. They're the basic internal structure of a team is the collective way that we do things. And if it's not explicit, if people have to guess what that is, or if they don't, they're guessing and they don't have the same idea, then there's a lot of opportunity for weakened trust or no trust to build. So part of what makes teams high performing is typically they're pretty explicit about a lot of agreements. And sometimes they have some implicit ones that they'll be like, oh, right, that's how we do things, and they'll agree on it. Or if you asked the team, you could know if you asked the team questions about how you do certain things, they would all tell you pretty much the same thing. That's a really good sign. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing about and we can talk more about agreements, but I just want to note the thing about cross-team. To your point, it's often explicit in cross-team about whose responsibility is to do what. But in high-performing cross-team situations, you do those things collaboratively anyway. Like, you would agree, you would have some discussion about what's the right set of priorities here. Even if that's owned by product, you would have some discussion about that. Even if the delivery schedule is owned by the delivery team, you would have some discussion with the other cross-functional teams to figure out what's optimal for the business.
And I think the value of those explicit agreements is kind of is understanding kind of who owns it, but certainly there should always be, in a collaborative and in a high performing environment, a lot of ability to go back and forth and discuss around that, right? But sometimes, especially if you're at a certain impasse, you reach a point where, you know, kind of like, well, somebody just has to make the call. Do we do A or B, right?
Amen.
And so for a given situation or across teams, we need to have that part pretty clear, right? And so an explicit agreement can help us to see that and get through those, the potentially tense moments, you know, without conflict, because we've already agreed that, you know, when we hit an impasse, this is the person or the role that decides that. Something else I was thinking about while you were describing that of explicit and implicit agreements was, I was thinking for a second about, you know, a lot of times a team, I was trying to think of a scenario where I knew, where there was a high performing team that did not have explicit agreements in my experience, and thinking, you know, could you have, maybe by accident, even if it's really rare, a high performing team with the only implicit agreements? And the couple of, you know, brief examples in my experience that were starting to come to my mind, I was realizing, you know, those weren't really high performing teams. They were teams kind of maybe being dragged along by a high performing individual, right? Mm-hmm. So if you really want to have a high performing team, not just, you know, that is a group of individuals collaboratively working together, pushing the ball together, you know, as opposed to just a team with one or two, you know, mythical 10X developers on it that's either pushing or dragging everybody along with them, or sometimes holding them back even, you know, you might be able to get away with decent performance in a scenario like that with only implicit agreements, but it's not really a high performing team. It's a collection of people that happens to have one or two stars in it. And I think, you know, as I was thinking about that, I think that's an important distinction maybe for us to draw, is that what we're really going for here is high performing teams, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the ways that I think about that is, if the leaders of a team have done a good job of setting norms and agreements so the team can work really effectively, the leader can step away a little bit. If they're not there all the time, some of those agreements are working on their behalf. And sometimes that can be super useful. Like, the leader can put focus elsewhere if needed, or the team can feel like they really own the process. And again, that can sort of lead to more trust and higher performing teams.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great metric, great measure. If you have a high performing team, can the leader step away, as well as can other individual members of the team step away too, right? If you've got that team that's over reliant on one 10X type of person, if you believe in that 10X type of person, I'm a little on the fence whether that really exists or not. I don't think it generally does. You're shaking your head no. But, you know, that's another good way to see if you have a high performing team versus, you know, one or two high performing individuals, is can anyone on the team step away and the team still, through those agreements, still be high performing when somebody goes on vacation or has a sick day or whatever. So let's talk a little more about the agreements. We've talked about the importance of these agreements, but who sets those agreements? What kind of processes do they need to follow to establish that agreement within the team?
So typically that's a role of a team leader, a manager, team leads, some combination, is usually taking the initiative on saying, like, how should we do this? Or just saying, let's do it this way. If you need to decree something that everybody isn't comfortable with right away, even if they are, sometimes it can be really useful to say, let's do this as an experiment. Whether it's something small, you run our agenda in Notion instead of in Google Docs, or it's something really big about how you're going to, who's taking responsibility for what, and you're changing roles in some kind of a delivery, or you are changing even how often you're meeting or the length of time, that those things can be pretty big. And if you're changing anything that feels significant to people, you can run it as an experiment. You can say, let's do it for this amount of time with the expectation it's going to generate this sort of benefit and these trade-offs for us. Let's put a date in the calendar in 3 weeks or 3 months, whatever is appropriate for the situation, and check in. And let's all discuss. We know we have that time coming up, so we're going to just give this our best. And if it goes sideways, we have time to check in and say, let's ditch it, let's refine it, let's pivot into something completely different. But you give yourselves the space to try something to get better information about how it's working and then make additional decisions.
Yeah, I really like the point you make there about setting a date on the calendar of, you know, let's review at this point in the future and see, you know, if this is working for us, because, you know, momentum can be a blessing and a curse, right? And if we've made a process change and it's not making any difference, or maybe it's even had a negative impact on our team somehow, still the momentum of that, you know, of that rule, of that agreement can just carry forward just regardless of whether it's been effective or not, or maybe the impact is not even across the team, that sort of thing. Do you have a way that that you think is better, or your favorite way maybe to measure the impact of a change? I mean, are you looking more for, like, say, if it's a software team, some sort of technical delivery metric? Are you looking for kind of thumbs up, thumbs down from the team, kind of satisfaction, or, you know, depends? What sort of, how do you measure the success of a change like that?
It really depends. Most of it is going to be more qualitative. How do we feel? But I think that part of what is important and is potentially trust building in these situations is having some discussion together about how we will know if this is working or not. And like 90% of the time, you'll say, well, we'll see how we feel. That's fine. That's good. That's human. Right. And that's cool. It's occasionally you will be able to say we're able to respond 50% more quickly to requests that are coming in, or we have cut down on the amount of discussion we're having about how to respond by, we've cut it down from 2 days to 2 hours. There's some times when you're making a change that it really is quantitative. And as a team, being able to agree what that is part of what's important.
Yeah. So at the beginning of making the change, you're agreeing on kind of a date, a time box to run this experiment within, as well as how are we going to measure the success or failure of this change. So in that sense, it's, you know, that's the way we should be measuring any change, whether it's a feature change in our application or a process a change within our team, you know, always having some sort of constraint around that and a way in advance that we're gonna determine that. But yeah, you know, there are things like service level agreements and response times, like you said, where we can be very quantitative. But yeah, especially when we're talking about trust-based things, which is such an important part of a high-performing team, that makes sense that most of this is not going to be measurable beyond a conversation. What about, I want to take a moment to tell you about our sponsor, WebRTC Ventures. At WebRTC Ventures, our teams are experts in building live video into your web or mobile applications. We've literally built hundreds of them. We have over a decade of experience using both open source and commercial media servers in a wide range of industries, including telehealth, edtech, broadcasting, and more. We also publish a lot of helpful tips and industry interviews on our website and our YouTube channel. So be sure to check out webrtc.ventures, and we can help you build, scale, and deploy your video solution. Coming up with, is there value? Do you see value? Or is it desirable for, in a large organization with lots of teams who maybe are each coming up with and should be able to come up with, I would say, their own team agreements up to a point. But as a leader across a larger organization, are there times when you want to enforce certain common elements in those team agreements?
I'm a little uncomfortable saying this to a person who has rolled deep in the Agile world, but I think that...
Go ahead. This is a safe space here. I don't agree with everything in Agile either. It's all right.
I think that there's quite a bit more harm than good done by dictating the common elements that a team should have. What you can do is say, we need these outcomes from your team. We need your team to talk about the schedule on which it's going to meet, how it's going to review work. There's a bunch of kinds of agreements that you can ask the team to be explicit about, but dictating how they meet those agreements is almost always counterproductive. It undermines the ability for the team to build that trust and to find what's best for the humans in that team. It's not going to be the same for every team. And I think that people so often, the cycles that people spend and waste in trying to either conform to a process that isn't a good fit for their team or rebel against it, there's no it's anti-value to the company. So let them know what you need, give them some guidelines for some things to talk, like the outcomes you need, give them some guidelines for how to talk, but don't dictate.
Yeah, no, that I completely agree with that. And yeah, certainly in the agile world, sometimes people, especially when they're trying to do agile at scale, they're looking to enforce things across an enterprise and, you know, pick whichever flavor of agile enterprise methodology you want. To some degree, you know, they all run the risk of taking autonomy away from teams and enforcing a variety of things. And, you know, and it's challenging, right? Because to in setting aside whether we're talking about agile or not is irrelevant. You know, anytime when you have a large organization, you know, whether you're talking about process or you're talking about enterprise architecture, to some degree, you're trying to establish certain things in common across the organization, but you can't dictate everything, certainly down to the team level. And especially when we're talking about things like trust, and, you know, such a common element of high performing teams, you can say that, hey, this is a big part of our corporate culture. Maybe it's important to us that our teams have trust within them. And, you know, maybe that's why we're encouraging you to come up with team agreements, but, you know, what it looks like to you, you know, may be different than others. So as team members come and go in an organization, for, you know, good or bad reasons, right? Team change always happens, right? So those team agreements may need to be revisited or even revised as people come and go. How do you incorporate new team members into an existing agreement with the same buy-in as the original team members had?
Yeah. I tend to think about that kind of two ways. So assuming things are working on the team, I normally would ask new team members, give them a strong orientation, both kind of in early one-on-ones and in the team itself. Here's the agreements we have. Let's make sure you know what they are, and ask the new team member or members to live with those for a couple of weeks or a couple of months before we take a look at them together again, so that they can sort of feel the impact of the agreements that we've made and they can understand what they are, how they work. They may then have some good feedback about the situation, some good outside perspective, but they have to live with it a little bit, also so that the team trusts that they understand what's up.
Right.
And anything they say can be useful, can trusted. But there's also like things aren't working when they come in. And it could also just be that like sometimes agreements need to be revisited. Every meeting has to be like, you need to check in on any kind of standing meeting. Do we need this every 6 months? Maybe even less,
like
more frequently, I mean. So everything needs to be checked in. These processes do not hold forever. So it's often an opportunity either to revisit something that is working or something that isn't working and needs new juice. You bring in a new team member, you can still say, here's how we've been doing things, but let's run some new experiments.
Yeah, I think any form of process should be kind of an ongoing, a living process, right? And so, yeah, that's a really good point. We want to make sure the team member is incorporated into the team before they're making a lot of change or suggesting a lot of changes, so that we know that they're, you know, we have the trust in them that they're not just trying to take over. Hey, I liked this thing that my other team did. I don't like what you're doing. I don't want to change. So I'll try to make you change with me as the new team member. So we have to get, you know, a little bit of time in so that no one feels like there's, you know, any other incentives like that going on, or just, you know, fear of change in general. But still recognizing that, yeah, we are going to continually update this. We're going to regularly update our team agreements. So that's how the the new team member becomes more and more part of the team. So I like that. I like that attitude towards it. Do you set a or encourage people to have kind of a regular schedule around that? I mean, you know, in Agile, we talk about like retrospectives, you know, potentially every 2 weeks and stuff like that. That would be a lot to try and make new team agreements every week or every 2 weeks. But yeah, do you encourage a regular schedule around that or just kind of as need arises?
It depends quite a bit on the team and like what stage the company's in, how much the team is changing. If you've got a schedule where you meet quarterly or twice a year and you're talking about more strategic things on your at your team level, it can be nice to set aside a piece of a little chunk of time within that to say, let's do a little retro on some of our processes and make sure they're meeting whatever new strategic initiatives we're talking about, any changes that have happened to the team in the last 3 to 6 months. If you don't have that baked in, then often you're kind of at a stage where it's fine to let it roll and make the adjustments just as needed. But it is on leaders to keep an eye on when you might need to make those and to be proactive about checking in with the team and keeping an eye on what's still working for us or what might be merit discussion.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, what could be triggers that would cause if a team doesn't have a regular schedule to revisit this, or even if they do, but maybe something is needed sooner than that schedule, what would be those external triggers that might cause it? And certainly the departure or entry of a new team member after some adjustment period could be one of those triggers. I was also thinking about maybe external stakeholders to the team have noticed maybe a negative change in output or quality or something like that, right? You know, what's your take on it? How much can an external stakeholder sort of not tell you what the agreement should be, but maybe sort of trigger you to revisit it?
Yeah. Well, if we go back to thinking about the definition of high performing teams, there's external and internal factors. Mm-hmm. If things on either of those axes are starting to slip in some way, if you are not generating good decisions or good product, good projects, whatever your outputs are, or if you aren't effectively getting everybody's input on the team in a respectful and satisfying way, either of those things could be a sign that it's time to revisit some agreements.
Let's talk a little bit about team agreements in the context of remote work. You and I have both throughout our careers, as probably most everyone listening to this, witnessed a lot of growth in remote and hybrid teams. You and I have also been part of organizations that are really based on doing remote work effectively. So I think we, you know, probably have a particularly, unique or more longstanding view of this type of thing. Is there anything special about team agreements for a team that is entirely remote, or do you see, you know, trust is trust? It's the same regardless of how the team interacts in physical or virtual world.
Two opposing answers to that. I think we should talk about trust on teams because I do think it works differently on remote teams than co-located teams. But I also, my other answer is that I used to think about team agreements as a little bit different on remote teams, that there was a special opportunity on remote teams. Because if you think about team agreements as a part of establishing team cohesion, it's sort of a way of saying, this is how we do things, which creates a we. There used to be a really special opportunity on remote teams because people didn't have a sense of how do we do things remotely. It wasn't nearly as common. So you had to kind of talk it through. It's much more common now that people either are on remote teams or have had the experience. And so the sense of we need to create what the norms are for remote teamworks, and that's going to be special for our little team, less the case now. I think it's true for every team that having agreements that are explicit that you've come to together forms cohesion, creates a we of the team. But I think it's not so special to remote teams anymore.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Maybe what... And I was just guilty of doing this myself, but, you know, oftentimes we talk about remote work or co-located work as kind of like an on-off switch that you either are or you aren't. But like most things, there's a continuum there, really, of not only a continuum at any single point in time of are you all co-located or hybrid or remote, but even over time, you know, companies sometimes change their policies, they change their hiring, all that sort of thing. So in that sense, at least, you know, it does, you know, like create an opportunity, like you said, still for when we move organizations or even within the organization move from one team to another, you know, maybe that, you know, to what degree we're remote creates that opportunity to say, let's revisit our team agreement or come up with a new team agreement, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a great point. That does change a lot. And every time it changes, it is an opportunity. And also, I didn't mention this before, but if you have a new team member who's joining and they're not in the same setup, if your whole team is typically co-located and they're remote, or somebody new is sometimes in an office with some other people, there's some hybrid thing that's new to the team, absolutely a time for like new agreements and figuring things out.
Absolutely. Sarah, you mentioned trust in remote teams. So let's come back to that topic. How is trust different when a team is primarily remote?
A number of years ago, after I'd been working on remote teams for a long time, I heard somebody say to me, well, of course, trust is lower on remote teams. And I said, without even thinking, actually, my experience has been the opposite. And then I got real curious about why I had said that. Why was my experience that trust was much higher on remote teams? And I did a bunch of research at the time. And it turns out that there's a personality factor that people almost never talk about, but is probably quite important for how we experience remote teams, which is some people have what's called a propensity for trust. They tend to trust other people, and they tend to feel trusted by other people out of the gate. Other people need to have it built up. And it sounds like if you have low propensity for trust, that's a judgment, but it's not. It's just a difference in how people operate. So some people, you start in a high place and people can like erode that trust in the ways they behave. Other people start in a pretty low place and they need to see it built up. And I think part of what happens is that for people who are happy on remote teams, you feel pretty trusting of the people who are, you're working with, and you feel trusted by them. And the remoteness actually reinforces that. The sense of the things we are doing, we believe in each other. For people who are on the other end of the spectrum, who feel not very trusted and feel like they can't trust people around them, I think part of it is that they tend to feel a lot of trust by seeing other people and being seen at work. The folks who are already at a high level feel surveilled by having to come in all the time and feel like they're being tracked. So there's like a very different psychological experience that's completely valid on either side. But I think as a result of that, in addition to some of the things that people talk about that we're much more familiar with, the social, like who likes a lot of social interaction and contact in person, get strained by that. I think there's some other factors that we're not as aware of that are about trust that are very important in remote teams and can lead to higher performing teams. Now, if you're a person who works on a remote team, or especially if you're one who leads a remote team, but you don't feel like you trust people remotely and you don't feel trusted, there are specific elements of trust that contribute to how people perceive and are perceived on teams that you can work with. So the elements of trust in teams, remote or otherwise, is that you think the other people on the team are reliable, capable, honest and committed to the common good, and you believe they think those things about you. So if you're running a team and you think that the trust is low, you don't trust other people, think about, do you think they're reliable? How could you, even if you can't see them sitting next to you, how they're not showing up every day in the way that lets you know they're reliable? What else can they do that lets you know that they're reliable? And what can you do to demonstrate to them that you are reliable? And so a lot of times that's things like everybody showing up to the meetings that you have. You may not be showing up to the office, but you're showing up to meetings on time. You're generating the work on the schedule that you've said you would. Are you capable? Are you doing the work at a high level? And if you're not doing it at the level that you think is right, are you talking about why it's not coming in at the level of quality or the time period? Things like that. You can really start to break down the elements of trust to help you get over any barriers that you might feel if you're a person for whom remote work is just not like a personality fit.
That's really interesting. And I really like that phrase, whether you have the natural, you know, propensity for trust. That's an angle on this I've never thought about before. I've always been very comfortable with remote work myself and with others being remote. And I thought about it more as, I certainly thought about it from the more traditional, like introvert, extrovert. You know, I can be extroverted in a meeting, but then go still sort of quietly sit in my corner after the meeting's over and get my introvert, side refreshed. And, I guess that means I'm high propensity to trust because I just want to be judged on, you know, are we getting things done? Are we working well together? And, you know, that's a really interesting perspective. I appreciate, I'm going to have to think about that more, myself, but yeah, I think it's really interesting. And when you talk about other things like reliability too, I mean, sometimes I think in a more remote environment, it can highlight those things because you see if somebody, is always kind of jogging back to their desk, coming into the meeting late, but literally jogging back to their desk, you know, because they were kind of distracted from that. But I also feel a higher sense of trust in people when I see a little bit of like their real lives. I guess it's kind of like it helps make them feel more genuine to me. And so in that sense, I feel more connected and have a little more trust. So if I, see their dog jump into frame and, whatever the case may be, stuff like that, that sometimes happens when we're working remotely. For me, I think that increases it.
I couldn't agree more. I have this weird experience now when I occasionally work with people in person and we don't have a remote relationship. I feel like, how can I get to know you? Like, I can't feel connected to you if I don't see you in your environment. I definitely feel that sense of intimacy and connection with people when you see their kids and their pets wandering around and you see their space a little bit. And of course, there's people who are not comfortable having those things on screen, and that's fine. But there is, having that as part of the shared experience for many people does create some connection.
Yeah. And although as much as I do like remote work and think it can enhance high performing teams, not distract from it or detract from it, I do want to give a shout out for kind of the concept of offsites and getting together in person too. And you know, I thought about this earlier when we were talking about how frequently should you revisit a team agreement and, you know, what should trigger that. I mean, if you're a company that does do regular, bring everybody in together in one location, or even better, go somewhere fun and, you know, have kind of a not too cheesy team building event. Those are great opportunities to build in some time for teams to kind of sit back, reflect on the last year or whatever it is and the team agreements and how things are going, you know, sort of a longer term retrospective type of view. So,
yeah, I'm in. I do certainly think that for fully remote teams, having the occasional IRL, whether that's quarterly, twice a year, once a year, can be extremely valuable.
So let's talk about one time for kind of one more quick question here. Because I know you've seen leaders in a variety of different organizations and companies at a wide range of different stages of growth, and you know, your expertise in lean startup movement, you know, comes into play here probably as well too. You've seen people at a lot of different stages of their personal and professional journeys and the companies at different stages of growth. How do you see the job of an engineering manager change over time as the company grows? And how does that impact their ability to lead high performing teams?
Yeah. So I think the main thing is that in earlier stage companies, the thing that the company needs to do and that you need to be focused on as a leader is building the product and finding product market fit. That's the job of the company before you're profitable, basically.
Right.
And the job of leadership is making sure that you're focused on that appropriately. As the company grows, then you start getting into the company building part, which probably comes later than you think, because product market fit comes later than you think, basically.
And always later than you hope.
Yes, right. Definitely later than you hope. That's a great point. Any time that you're putting into the company building is basically something that could be completely lost as soon as the company goes out of business. And the company is going to go out of business or stay in business based on the strength of the product, not on the strength of your performance review system. Now, like, I don't want to, there's lots of parts of company building that are important for making sure that you can attract and retain talent. But understanding where you are in that, on that spectrum from very early stage into established, profitable, all of that, and making the appropriate adjustments for focusing on product versus company building, that's really, those are very different sets of focus and somewhat different skills for a manager. And one of the most important things is for managers to be able to recognize what stage you're in and lead the appropriate kinds of development for that stage.
Makes a lot of sense and requires a good amount of self-reflection too. You know, I've certainly figured out for myself, I enjoy those earlier stage ventures, or even when, you know, kind of working with other larger companies, what's the aspects of that process that still feel early stage when you're building a new team, you're pulling together, you know, finding high performers and helping them explore some new product, that sort of stuff I find super exciting. But then, you know, we get to the point of, you know, we need to have some more established process and that process documented. I just drop.
Yeah.
Totally, you know, but, you know, so as a leader, it's important to know that those sorts of things about yourself and to be able to, you know, recognize when that's necessary, even if it's not your thing, right? And be able to delegate that to others, perhaps, is, you know, what I try to do. Or in some cases, you know, maybe it's the right time for you as a leader to kind of move on to a different team, a more, you know, flashier group within that organization, or even a whole new organization, perhaps.
Yeah, that self-awareness is critical.
Well, Sarah, I really appreciate the time you've taken to speak with us today. How can our listeners get in touch with you and learn more about your work?
At sarahmilstein.com.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah. Really appreciate you joining us today on the Scaling Tech Podcast.
Thank you so much.
On behalf of the thousands of developers we've placed with our clients, I want to briefly tell you about our sponsor, Agility Feed. Agility Feed has been building nearshore agile teams for U.S. companies since 2010. We were an early pioneer in doing this sort of developer staffing. Our team can help you recruit talented software engineers and technical teams in Latin America. We'll handle all aspects of recruiting, contracting, and payments for you so you can focus on delivering great software. To learn more, check us out at agilityfeat.com. That's agilityfeat.com.